are circling around four questions. It's probably not surprising that they're very concerned about increasing revenue, reducing costs, retaining current clients, and developing their employees. Now, this pilgrim has been very curious to learn how company leaders have been addressing these questions, because the way they address these questions is going to have a lot to do with where they are 3 to 5 years from now. Every CEO or business owner gets to try his or her hand at answering these questions because they are the key questions in this economic marketplace. Now, I've heard a number of different answers to the question about increasing revenue. I've heard business leaders working to develop new products. I've heard others talk about repositioning existing products. Some have decided to take market share from competitors, while others have sought to enter new marketplaces, either here or around the world. Now, I'm sure that there are many more answers to these questions. Each of them requires research, strategy, and tactics to succeed. Now, I've heard from business leaders who've tried to cut costs that they have exhausted the obvious cost-cutting measures. And to further reduce costs, they're looking at even more creative options. They're looking for ways to shorten the sales cycle, ways to reduce resources necessary to complete sales. They're looking to automate marketing and lead generation. The serious CEOs are examining as many ways as possible to leverage the power of technology to increase the effectiveness of their people and reduce the amount of resources needed to complete their tasks. Now, this means developing and training their people to make the best use of technologies. Training and development are and will continue to be a significant part of many strategies moving forward. Not only has the marketplace changed in the past few years, the available technologies have continued to morph into faster, better, and more effective tools which can be used to increase productivity and get stronger returns on investment, and those investments in people, processes, and production. The last question is how to retain current customers and clients. And remember an important rule. My best customer is my competitor's best product. Again, my best customer is my competitor's best product, prospect. You got to know that he's getting calls from my competitors, if not every day, at least every week. Getting and staying close to current customers, asking what could be done better, anticipating their needs, giving them the best strategic advice we can offer to improve their company will go a long way to countering the inevitable attempts of competitors to buy customers by dropping the price in the short run. Now, I've been looking around Orange County for the past couple of weeks, asking people, what are creative ways? What are ways to cut to the bone? What are ways to change processes, technologies? What are ways to shorten sales cycles? What are ways to increase revenue? Friends of mine have pointed to one fellow who's doing a great job in advising 4 or 5 companies as an interim general manager on how they can accomplish these 4 tasks. We've had great conversations, and so I want to welcome Mike Schmidt, who has been doing a lot of work around Southern California to help companies to be more creative and more effective in this marketplace. Mike, welcome to the show, and thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks, Will. Thanks very much.
So tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing these days, and then we'll jump right into these 4 questions.
Okay. You know, I graduated from school, like a lot of us, about 18, 19 years ago, and went directly into work in my field of study, and got the opportunity to help the company I was with fix parts of the business that weren't working very well, and kind of developed a specialty on fixing either branches or divisions that weren't working well, and I've been able to parlay that over the last several years into helping companies throughout the desert Southwest, work on their businesses, work on their development and management, identifying where there are opportunities to increase the capacity of their workforce, refine their sales processes to make certain that they don't have as much leakage, you might say, in the, you know, in the sales process and capture more opportunities. Identify which parts of the business are making more money and which ones are starting to hurt them. So we should maybe de-emphasize those things or rethink the way that we do accomplish those. And you know, lastly, just really look for that ultimate end game. Understand how to monetize what we do, how to articulate the value that that company provides to its customer base, so we can go through and determine, you know, use that as a method of growth.
All right, so let's jump into these questions, and let's just take them on one at a time. What have been some of the most effective ways that you have found to increase revenue for the companies you're working with?
Yeah, I think one of the things you should always look at is who is your current customer and what percentage of their existing opportunity does your firm capture today? And you know, sometimes that's an easy question, sometimes that's not such an easy question, but, you know, probably the easiest sale to make is that sale to a customer that's already happy with the services you're providing. So can you go through and provide them a different service than you're providing now, or more of the same service that you're current providing? Maybe in a lot of our service, you know, a lot of the companies I work with are service providers. So a lot of times our customers manage their own portfolios, and we'll do 2, 3, 10, 12 units within their portfolio, but that may only represent 10 to 60% of their total opportunity. How do we work it out so that my customers have an opportunity to do a larger percentage of that 2, 3, 10, 12 units within their portfolio, but that may only represent 10 to 60% of their total opportunity. How do we work it out so that my customers have an opportunity to do a larger percentage of that potential target's portfolio base? That's sometimes the easiest way to go.
So look specifically at each customer and asking what percentage of their business am I getting and how can I increase that percentage?
Yes. And at the end of the day, as a service provider, a lot of times we're a necessary evil to the customer. The customer makes money. You know, our customers make money a lot of times managing property, managing assets. Doing things that have some sort of long-term, you know, passive income. So the fact that they need to maintain whatever it is that they're managing is something that they need to do. But what is it that we do that is similar to something else that they also buy or consume, so that we could go through and expand our services that way?
So have you worked with companies who have added on new services or deepened their offering, changed their offering?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, in today's economy, when margins are getting tighter and the tendency is for a service provider to become commoditized, how do you offer new and unique service offerings to help expand that? You know, in one case, I'm helping a landscape construction company up in the San Fernando Valley, and they've been around about 35 years, and they've been able to exist largely on the revenues generated from their landscape construction operations. In today's market, with the decline in construction, both on residential and commercial side, they're seeing their margins get tighter and tighter as there are more and more competitors for those same opportunities. So what we're doing there is really working on developing a recurring revenue stream through the maintenance operations, but then looking at things like tree services or sweeping services, you know, things that maybe they didn't look as core pieces of business, but yet their customers are currently buying from somebody else, or maybe not buying, but could really use and would add value to their, you know, to their properties. So that's a way that we can go through and yield a higher margin, provide additional value to the customer, start to decommoditize some of our primary offerings, and seek to get a little bit better than industry average on the margins of the work that we're doing currently.
So that's an interesting concept. We're going to decommoditize. Now I've heard of resisting commodification. What tactics can you suggest to decommoditize?
I think one of the key things that any service provider, and I think this goes across all industries, but understand who your customer is, understand what's important to them and how they make money or how they monetize whatever it is that they do, and then really think hard about what is it that you're doing to help them in their either running their operation more efficiently or producing long-term value, and then speak in the same language that your customer speaks in or at least thinks in. Sometimes we get so focused on what the service is that we provide that we forget that we're serving somebody who doesn't necessarily think exactly the way we think or think in the same terms. So can we go through and translate the way we provide our services into a way that resonates with the way they do their business so that that customer really looks at you as a valued partner, as a value-added service, to where you almost become an indispensable part of their team? If you can get to that point, and it sometimes takes, you know, it takes some time, and it takes some real thinking, and it takes some real dedication on your part as a service provider to build those relationships. But when you get to that point, you've now decommoditized yourself. You've made yourself invaluable, and you've really changed the way the formula works in terms of how you can charge for your services. Money and the price is always important. But when you've reached that level of relationship, you've gotten to a point where money is not the most important thing.
Okay. All right. So one way to increase revenue is to get closer to my clients. Take a look at how much they're spending with me of their possible spend and what I can do to increase, deepen the relationship, provide more services, and become less of a vendor and more of a strategic partner.
Correct.
What about getting new customers?
Sure. You know, today you've got a lot of folks that are knocking on a lot of doors looking for new customers. And I think that as you develop these better relationships with your existing customer base, it's the perfect time when you've become that valued resource, when you become that strategic partner, like you had mentioned just a moment ago. It's a great time to ask for references. Who is it that your customer knows that might also be able to use services like you're providing? Or who is it that you might want to be introduced to? And start to get that recommendation into their trusted group of advisors or competitors or partners and start to expand your business that way. Nothing works as well as a recommendation like that.
So when I become a strategic partner of my customer, there's an opportunity for me to be open to my customer becoming a strategic partner of mine.
Absolutely. It's a two-way street. At least the best relationships are a two-way street. If it really is a one-way street, I would suggest that maybe you haven't truly arrived at that point of strategic partner. The term partner, it would imply that both parties are looking out for the interests of the other.
Okay. What about reducing costs? Now, I mean, there's some obvious things that people do. Well, let me ask you. As you work with a company for the first time, do you find that they have found all the obvious places to cut costs, or are there places that that people generally ignore?
I think people look for the noisy costs and look to seek to reduce there sometimes. But sometimes a subtle cost is productivity. One of the ways that I like, and a lot of my customers are labor-intensive businesses, and we don't always think of ways and things that we can invest in to increase productivity in what is oftentimes for my customers one of their largest costs, which is cost of labor. And they'll think that all labor is the same sometimes and look at it as a very linear function. I need, you know, X number of dollars of labor to generate X amount of revenue. I've found it to be pretty successful to understand what efforts have been made into the labor pool, labor stream there, to enhance their capacity to do work and to be able to leverage the dollars that you're currently spending to produce more revenue per dollar of labor. That's a cost. It's a hidden cost. It doesn't seem, a lot of folks don't look at it as cost cutting, but it truly, if you can go through and learn how to get more revenue out of each dollar spent in a fashion, it's a form of labor cutting or cost cutting.
Now, does that imply, am I hearing you talk about development, training, helping people be more productive?
Yes. Yeah. My customers range in all kinds of different industries, you know, everything from aviation to the green industry, medical industry. And in each case, there's a common theme, and it's service. And their customers generally value a longevity of employee who's providing that service. And if you invest in that employee, you're more likely to retain that employee longer, which should and usually does result in a longer-term customer relationship. In the service business, the longer you can maintain a customer, it's been my experience that the more profitable that customer relationship becomes.
Mm-hmm. And now, have you ever found resistance from somebody who's looking at the bottom line and saying, I can't afford to invest in training? That's a cost.
That is, yeah, certainly you do. Certainly you do. But you also find that those are sometimes from a, you can find short-term cost reduction, but they very often lead to longer-term problems in revenue retention and or the ability to secure new work. Because when we're trying to decommoditize ourselves and we're trying to get as large a margin or as healthy a margin as we possibly can for the dollars that we're spending, it's sometimes, you know, two different sides there. And so you have to, in my opinion, you've got to invest in certain areas. You can always cost reduce. There are certain things you can cost reduce. You can look at your overhead. You can look at your percentage of or your number of managers to employees. And you can do some things that are obvious cost controls, utilities, you know, basic regular overhead costs, restructuring your debt, things like that you can maybe make an opportunity or a case for. But I always like going to that labor dollar first, since it's usually our biggest cost, and trying to understand how to make it the most efficient possible.
Mm-hmm. Rather than just cut in when I look at my labor costs, look at how I can make that more productive.
Correct.
Now, is in doing that, is there any, have you found it helpful to be recruiting, looking around the marketplace for better employees?
You know, that's a great question, because I think that the best organizations are constantly looking for the best talent on their team. Not to the exclusion of the people that have helped get them there necessarily, but it kind of goes to this old storyline in Good to Great, where we talk about putting the right people in the right seats in the bus, and if you're always looking and always analyzing, you know, all of my customers will maintain an org chart, and on that organizational chart it'll have everybody, or you know, for some, most of the organizations we'll need several because we've got so many employees. But on those org charts, we maintain each individual as a green, yellow, or red person on the organizational chart. And in today's cost cutting, we have had to let some folks go or lay them off. And at the same time, we've got a ranking to understand where our opportunities are to develop folks. If you're a green or a yellow, and green is promotable to the next position. Yellow is a question mark, maybe just right in the right position, maybe one position higher than where they should be, but has the right attitude. A red mark or a red box on the org chart would suggest that's somebody we need to upgrade and move on, help them find another opportunity someplace.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're always looking for not only new sales opportunities, we're also looking for new employee opportunities. We're looking in the marketplace to see who's available, to see how that fits with the slots that we have that we're looking to fill. And always comparing what we have with what's out there. Does that make sense?
It completely makes sense. I think in today's business environment, whether we're in a growing economy or we're in a stagnating economy, we always have to be working on our business. If we're not working on our business, I'd assume that my competitor is working on their business, and that I'm potentially starting to lose market share. The more I work on my business and both improving my quality of my customer and improving the quality of my employee, the better I'm able to compete in the tough times, and the stronger I'm going to be in the good times.
And it would seem to me that at the same time that we are developing our employees to help them become more productive to reduce our costs, that we're also building a loyalty with them, which would help to build some resistance to, you know, my best employees, which are probably the ones who are left around after the cost cutting. My best employees are my competitors' best recruits, right?
You know, your best employees are you know, your competitors want them the most. But if you've done a great job of building and investing in that employee, very often I've found that we have a strategic advantage to our competitor, because we've created an expectation in that employee that the next place they go also spends time, energies, and efforts developing them, helping them get to the next level, helping them increase their ability to provide for their family. And so we've set a bar that not all of our competitors choose to participate at in terms of a level of competition. So you're correct. Your competitor very much wants your employee, but if you're doing a good job and you're communicating with your employee and your employee understands how they can make more money and how they can provide better for their family through investing in themselves and using the tools that you've made available to them, that employee becomes pretty secure over the long term.
Yeah, and so we're really talking about how companies can be the best. I mean, they can be highly productive even in a tough marketplace.
Sure, your average hourly cost might actually be up, but I would expect that if you've set up the proper training systems and the proper promotional, and you've been consistent within the entire organization, you don't play favorites. You know, you have a set program that people use to advance themselves and advance their careers, that your actual cost of labor per hour might go up, but I would expect your productivity to have risen at a much greater incline than what the cost of labor did, so that you can make 2 to 3 times.
So help me to understand. All right, good. So help me understand, how do you measure productivity?
You know, the easiest way for me to measure productivity, and it's pretty applicable in almost every business that I'm in, is how many hours do we work over a day, a week, a month, a year, whatever it is, and how much revenue did we generate over that period of time, and measure that on a regular basis. Now, that works real well in the service business. In an asset business, you know, it doesn't work quite as well, and you have to look for some other metrics. But if you can just go into your normal payroll system and divide the total number of hours worked in a month into the total amount of revenue generated, both on a gross and a net basis, you can start to track pretty quickly. That's something that even a company that doesn't have a sophisticated job costing system can start to understand, hey, am I making headway or am I losing ground?
Mm-hmm. And those are some of the dashboards, some of the metrics that CEOs need to be looking at on a regular basis.
I think dashboards, you bring up a great point. It's amazing how many of my friends that are running businesses or how many of the companies that I come into, and they're a little confused about the whole idea about dashboard. It doesn't need to be hard, but it you know, every good CEO that I know that's happy and comfortable doing the job that he's doing has those anywhere between 3 and 10 items that are on their dashboard that they can easily look to and get a pulse within about 15 minutes as to how their business is doing on a daily basis or a weekly basis or a monthly basis. And it gives them a lot of comfort in being able to understand. And it gives them some sense that, hey, when something starts to go sideways, they can be ahead of the curve and they can go through and address that issue before it became, you know, an overwhelming issue.
Yeah, and have dashboards with metrics for each of these four areas that seem to be critical these days. Most people are focusing on these four. How do I increase my revenue? What metrics am I going to use to find out whether, in fact, I am increasing my revenue? How am I reducing my costs, increasing my productivity? What metrics will we use for that? Are my current customers, am I doing the behaviors that I have strategically determined will keep my current customers on board? And what's the results of the development of my employees, and how am I doing that? I mean, it seems to me that having a comprehensive, simple but comprehensive set of KPIs that are going to be reflected in my dashboards is essential today. Now, are the people you're working with, do they all have those dashboards sitting on their desk?
Well, they either have them currently, or we're in the process of building them. And it's one of the things that I really believe strongly in. In trying to simplify your business and simplify the key components so that you're not overwhelmed with what the activity. A lot of my customers are generational transition companies, I call them, where very often it's the first or second generation passing it on to the second or third generation. And so for the children that are coming up that are being asked to start leading these companies that their dads or grandfathers have been running, you know, to them it's a little bit overwhelming. For the dads and the granddads, they've grown up in it and they've become accustomed to it. Many times these guys have been running these businesses for 20, 30 years, maybe longer, and so it's just become an innate intuition for them to understand how that business works. Well, the grandchildren and the children haven't had the luxury of growing up and making all those mistakes, and really there's not the tolerance any longer for some of the mistakes that were made 15, 20 years ago, and yet the organization doesn't have the key performance indicators in place to make it simple. And so a lot of what I do is come in and try to help understand the business, talk to the founders or the folks that are in charge today, understand how they look at their business, and then determine through the financial tools, the accounting tools, the human resources tools, the customer satisfaction tools that are available, how can we come up with a simple dashboard so that people can get comfortable with what the job is they're being asked to do today? And then if they don't have some of those things in place, look for pretty simple ways to implement those into an organization. So you're not having to do, you know, $1 million software conversions. You're not having to do, you know, monster investment, but you can still get high results. It's, you know, I'm a big believer in the 80-20. How do I get to 80% of the information I need with 20% of the effort so that I can continue to focus on what's important, which is providing my customer value, developing my employee, and at the end of the day, you know, bringing a return to my shareholder.
Yeah, and while that's not necessarily simple to do, it is simple to watch once we have defined our goal. That's the strategy. Once we have the tactics, and then we have the metrics to measure it, then it becomes a simple thing each day to take a look at that. And it seems to me that's the discipline of noticing when, as you mentioned, when it begins to go sideways, and then something about it.
I think that word discipline is really important. In today's economy, you know, we talk about how do we add customers, how do we cut costs, how do we add to our bottom line, and I think it really comes to those disciplines. The more disciplined you are as an executor today, the easier it is going to be to go through and survive down the road. And if you've got the disciplines to continue to ask yourself these questions, to continue to enhance your business, to invest in your employee, to understand and communicate with your customer, those disciplines are really what's going to separate the folks that are here 10 years from now versus the folks that may not be here 10 months from now.
All right. So, Mike, one of the things we do on the show is we're talking to Orange County CEOs. So if you had a minute and you had a megaphone, and you could use that megaphone to address CEOs in Orange County, what would you tell them to do?
I'd say get out and speak to your customers. I think in today's, whether we're producing a product, we're giving a service, it doesn't matter. We need to spend more time not living in a bunker, but getting out and talking to our customers, understanding how our customer values our services, values our product, try to understand how else we might be able to provide value to our customer, and then put our, you know, wrap our brains around making those types of things happen, build those long-term relationships. I think in when the money was coming easy, we had a tendency to sit back and as CEOs not always have intimate relationships with our key customers. I think today is no time like today to go out there and get to know your key customers, build those long-term relationships, understand what stresses they're going through, and try to figure out how to work with them to solve some of those issues.
All right. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time. If somebody wanted to talk with you to continue the conversation and see if there was something that you could do to help them, how would they get in touch?
You know, I have a cell phone on my hip just about all the time. That's probably the best way, and that phone number would be 714-920-9125. Additionally, you can always get me by email, which is at Mike Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, 318@yahoo.com.
All right. Well, thanks, Mike. I really do. This has been just a real joy, and just with pencil point precision, you have outlined for CEOs what kinds of things they need to be doing to be around and be thriving in the next 5 to 10 years. So I thoroughly enjoyed having you on the show. Thank you very much.
Will, thank you for the opportunity, and I wish you for your future success on your show, and I'll be a regular listener.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye. So here we are on OC Talk Radio at octalkradio.net. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back to one of those generational CEO exchanges with a fellow from Mark Beamish Waterproofing. So we'll be back with Adam just after a short break.
Today, 5 to 20% of every company's marketing budget is spent creating just two things, inquiries and sales leads. And yet only 10 to 25% of the demand is ever pursued by a company's sales channel. On the Sales Lead Management Association website, you'll find 250-plus articles from 55 authors covering both B2B and B2C inquiry. They'll also cover lead generation and what to do with them once you get them. During our most recent quarter, we had over 20,000 visitors and 51,000 pages viewed. So if you haven't already, go to www.theslma.com and sign up for your free membership today. That's www.theslma.com. And now back to Will Crist and his next guest.
Well, we are fortunate today to be able to follow up on the conversation about moving through the generations. Mark Beamish Waterproofing has been around for a long time, and we'll hear from Adam that his dad, Mark, began from some very humble beginnings, developing a caulking process that revolutionized the industry, and over the years has grown to a substantial business here in Orange County and doing this throughout the region. And now, as Adam begins to take the reins, I want to welcome Adam to the show and let him begin to tell us a little bit about what it's like to take over the reins of such a tremendous company as Mark Beamish Waterproofing. So welcome, Adam.
Hi, thank you, Will. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I think looking around, you might be one of the younger CEOs of a major company in Orange County.
That's possible.
So tell us a little bit about you know, what's happened in the past couple of years. What sorts of things have you been focusing on?
Well, you know, my... kind of the evolution of my involvement with the company When I got out of college, didn't really have a whole lot of interest in joining the family business. My father had really downplayed the opportunity of working with him. I think he was encouraging me to try some other things. So I spent about a year after college trying some other things, worked in real estate, commercial, and residential. And after that, had felt like I'd seen enough and wanted to find out more about the family business. And from there, kind of worked my way up. Spent a lot of time in the field, did the fun job of trying to collect money for a while, did some operations and scheduling work, and eventually opened up a new branch in the San Diego market. Found a lot of success down there doing that, and after a couple of years, my father felt it was time for me to come back home and work at the headquarters here and handle a lot of the administrative and managerial duties here.
So tell us a little bit about what does the company do?
Well, we're a waterproofing, sealant, and coating installer, subcontractor, focused primarily on commercial and industrial construction.
Now, we've been looking at, over the past couple of months, we've been looking at talking to CEOs, and we've come to discover that there's probably four questions that they're asking right now. Number one, how do I increase revenue? Number two, how do I reduce costs? Number three, how do I retain my current customers? And number four, how do I develop my employees? How do I keep them loyal? How do I help them become as productive as they can possibly be? Would you be willing to talk about each of those four questions along the line and talk about what are the strategies that you're using for that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that would probably be exactly what my focus has been over the previous 2 years here, taking on as the president of the company. Definitely felt the challenges of trying to identify new markets. We had tried an expansion to San Diego and also to Phoenix, Arizona, and then more recently, we tested out the market in Honolulu and obviously just trying to spread the net wider and found a lot of challenges in that. What we really decided to hone in on is we brought back into the home market here and tried to identify other services we could provide to our customers. We started the company in 1982 just doing one trade. We're doing vertical sealants for the big box or distribution construction and kind of along the 15 corridor there in the Inland Empire. We had taken a big part of that boom, just caulking those tilt-up buildings out there, those big concrete tilt-ups off the 15. And we evolved over the years just by picking up similar trades. Customers would be asking us to do this or try this trade, and before we knew it, we're into some pretty complex and varied installations. So after having some success in Honolulu, some success in Phoenix, decided to back off out in those markets and focus on trying some different kind of trades out here. And what we really found a lot of success with was kind of burst into doing some commercial flooring. We're trying some, we've been doing polished floors and stained floors, something that's really caught on with the tenant improvement market. And just been a blessing. My father had the foresight to pick up that business about 4 or 5 years ago and really focused in on it recently. Became a big part of our business recently. The other thing he asked about was employee retention or employee growth, and really focusing on one-on-ones with my management team, encouraging them to have one-on-ones with their teammates as well, and just trying to connect each other. We're real busy. We feel like we're lean and mean right now, and everyone's taking on substantial workload, but we just want to continue to connect with each other, find areas for improvement, not just procedurally, but also interpersonally. That's been a big focus.
Well, let's go back to increasing revenue for a moment, mm-hmm. if we can. What I'm hearing is that you are listening to your customers, and that mm-hmm. that's been something that your dad did all along. Is
correct.
That right?
Absolutely. When we started, like I said, we were just doing that one small trade, and customers took notice of the way my dad was doing business. He was a small-time operation, run the business out of his garage. And, you know, he had a truck, and he felt like he could fill it with, you know, four guys plus himself. And their production methods really shocked his customers at how quickly they could get the work done. And, you know, in conversation with the customers, they'd express their frustration with their other sub-trades. And had asked my dad to try like roller applied like painting on waterproofing to basement walls. He felt like, well, I got a truck and I got four other guys and I think we can try to do this. And so our business really grew in that manner, just listening to customers, finding out where they were having scope gaps, problems finding good subcontractors, and figure out whether or not we could satisfy their needs and be efficient in those trades.
Okay, and that's continued to grow even today.
Absolutely.
So that's what we've found all along. Being highly customer centric is a key component to growth in today's marketplace. It's not so much a matter of what you can do well; it's what your customer needs to have done, and then you go out and learn how to. That well.
Absolutely. We've been really reflecting over the last couple of years as the economy has obviously tightened and taken a long, hard look at ourselves in the mirror. You know, obviously, we're all trying to look for what is our differentiator, you know, and feel like quality of work is first, and second to that is responsiveness to the customer. And, you know, we don't know what they want if we're not asking them. So that's a big part of our business, is finding out what we can do better and what else they need or are looking for in a subcontractor.
Now, when we were talking the other day, you were telling me that you have processes, you've developed the processes and systems for knowing every construction project that goes on in Orange County. Is that right? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I wouldn't say I can take credit for developing the system. But being around for 30-odd years in the industry and doing good work, we get invited to bid on nearly every project in the marketplace here from the general contractor population. So our customer list is in excess of 1,000 customers here in Southern California. And they've, you know, amongst the 1,000 of them, one of each of them would have an idea of what projects are going on. And so from that, we've got a real busy bid list, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably bidding on average. I've got six guys that read plans, and they're probably doing about 5 new takeoffs a day. So we're pumping out a ton of bid opportunities.
Wow. Now, let me share with you what I've heard was there's no construction going on in Orange County. Now, where are you getting? Tell me. That doesn't sound to me like that's what's going on.
Well, you know, I mentioned bidding, and you know, I feel like a lot of people are interested in what they can get something done for. I was actually on a call today with a customer following up on a bid proposal I'd worked up, and you know, the owners are fishing to see what they can get done at what price, and they throw it back out to rebid, and so it's a lot of bid activity, and every time you have to rebid it, the price seems to come down a little bit. So there's definitely a lot of big bid activity, but there is a lot of construction activity. You know, in differentiating into the floor coatings and floor finishes business, three to 5 years ago, really getting strong in it, has given us a lot of opportunity on these tenant improvements and rehab projects where there may not be a new building being put up, but people are moving, and you know, they want to redo parts of their interior of their office, and we've been able to participate in that by having that floor division. In the past, you know, if it wasn't new construction, there was very little need for caulking or joint sealant or waterproofing, but we've found that they have a need for a floor sealer or a decorative polished floor or a stained concrete floor. And we've been able to find work in places that there would not have been work for us several years ago. So that's been able to keep us busy and employ the group of nearly 100 employees we have here.
Wow. So tell me what you've been doing to retain. What kind of programs, what kind of processes, what kind of things do you do to retain your current customers?
Well, you know, like I pointed to earlier, the quality of work is key. In this economy, they're not looking to give you second, third chances. You've got to do the job right the first time. So they're really looking for that, and they want to know that you care. So we actually invested about a year and a half ago in an outside salesman, a business developer. And with the volume of bidding that we're doing, it takes a lot of time behind the desk looking at plans. And it had been challenging for us to get in front of the customers, get to know them, smoke a cigar with them or take them golfing like we had been able to do in the past. And the investment in a outside salesman or business developer has really helped us to keep a pulse of what the customers are doing, get to know them a little bit more. And that business developer has managed the estimators or the project managers' relationships with the customers. So we'll all be looking at plans behind a desk. He's out there setting an appointment for me where I can come in for a 30-minute presentation, and it's not taking me all the legwork to get that face-to-face meeting with the customer. So that's definitely paid off for us. I know there was a challenge for us at the time to really consider if we want to invest more in a sales team, but have felt that the right individual has made a difference for us, absolutely.
Okay. So you've certainly got a return on your investment.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about how you measure your business. I mean, with Mike just before you, we were talking about dashboards and metrics and data that's coming in. What are the key things that you look for? I guess maybe key performance indicators.
Well, you know, our business, we're kind of old school. I mean, my dad, when he introduces himself, he says he's a construction worker. So, he's never mentioned that he's a business owner or an entrepreneur. He's just a construction worker in his mind. So, I'd say in terms of what I've seen out there, we're probably a little behind the rest in terms of metrics and measurables. But we've been working really hard on a program we're calling Win the Day. We're measuring everybody's performance, all our field guys' performance on a daily basis. Setting stretch goals for them and measuring their success and measuring them against each other, so there's a competitive element there. But in terms of key indicators I'm looking at, I'm really looking at billing per man hour. That's a big indicator to us in terms of what's like our billing rate. That's a big item I look at. Also looking at the volume of bids I'm putting out, the dollar amount on the bids I'm putting out. Those are the numbers that I'm looking at to give me a dashboard perspective of where we're going.
Do you watch margin? Do you have a metric for margin on a short-term basis, or is it only quarterly that you look at what the results have been?
We're watching the margin all the time. We look at it on a job-to-job basis. We feel if we're profitable on each job, then at the end of the month or the quarter or the year, we'll be fine. So we're measuring on a job-to-job basis. And because our scope is typically very small, we're doing obviously hundreds of thousands of small jobs. Our minimum is, $550 to, we just did a job that was $1.2 million just completed. So, we've got to measure those small ones as well as the big ones to make sure we're on track on a daily basis.
Now, talk to me about what you said that quality was one of the ways that you kept your customers, and you can't. There's no room for messing up. How do you measure quality? How do you keep your people doing quality? What does that mean?
Well, the field supervision is key. I'm fortunate to inherit the reins of a company where the majority of our field foremen and superintendents have been with us for 15, 20 years. So several of them have been with us since my dad started the company. So, the quality has already been bred into our lead guys. In terms of measuring, I've got superintendents out managing crews, and they're floaters, because I've got anywhere between 15 to 20 crews out a day. And they go out and to make sure that quality job is being done. And obviously pictures and written documentation are the key for us to ensure that we're getting done the quality that we need.
Okay. All right. And so do you review that periodically, or is it only come up, is it management by exception when there's a problem, or do you have a regular program for assessing the quality of your jobs?
You know, it's definitely, again, everything we're doing is on a job-to-job basis right now just because each job is so critical. Weekly, we're reviewing our schedule. We're looking at every job that we're doing and making sure that those jobs are coming in you know, under budget and the job is being done well. It's just a lot of communication on, you know, daily, hourly basis, making sure the foreman is communicated with and that we're getting the expected results on the job.
All right. So now, this movement from one generation to another, have you found that coaching has been helpful?
Yes, absolutely. You know, again, my dad refers to himself as a construction guy, and he really downplays his role in the company or in the world. But his humility, I think, has really benefited me. I know at first coming in, young 20-year-old guy trying to establish myself, there's a temptation to really want to make a name for myself or make big changes. But you know, his steady hand and his leadership and has really helped prepare me for the economy and for the times that, we're in. You know, I also think getting a little dose of the bad economy has helped me a lot, just to not get too high. Not to get too high on what we're doing or who I am and what I'm doing. So it's giving me a little dose of, reality. So that's helped. Mm-hmm. He also enrolled me in a coaching group, a membership in a small group of business professionals that we meet monthly and discuss some of our challenges and try to help each other get better. So that's helped a ton as well.
Good. Good. So having some outside coaching, some outside resources, some third-party objectivity, along with some expertise to guide you along the way has been helpful.
Yeah. I mean, I would we would not be where we are today if I didn't have some third parties looking into me. My dad just really drove into me growing up that, you know, a wise man seeks the counsel of many. And I've always kind of hung my hat on that, that, you know, I need the counsel of many to be successful and to accomplish what I'm trying to do here. So,
excellent. Well, now I want to move to a little bit different part of your company, because you have some strong values in your company culture, and you do. There were several things that you are doing as a company to benefit others. Take a couple of minutes and tell me about that.
Well, you know, another thing that my dad has really taught me is that, you know, we're not, we don't exist to make money. And, you know, we're here for to benefit others. And so he's always shown me that, you know, the value of giving back to community. He's always given well more than what is expected of him. And he's given of his, not just of his money, but of his time, and made a real good example for me in that. Another thing that he's given me that I have written on my wall is, freely you have received and freely give. And that's really driven me personally. And when I got the opportunity to start to take a leadership role here, we started creating some community-oriented events. A couple years ago, we started with, we threw a party for customer appreciation. And it was a real fun time, and everybody really enjoyed it. But afterwards, we were kind of sitting at a restaurant, and my dad mentioned to me. He said, "You know, this was nice, but this we could have done something better here." And we're like, "Oh, what do you mean? It was a great party. Everybody enjoyed themselves." He's like, "Well, look at how many people were here, how many people were excited about getting together." And he says, "Just think about what if all these people were unified on the same purpose to make our world a better place, our community a better place." And so the following year, we threw a party in L.A. to to announce a new branch we were opening in the Los Angeles area. And we decided to, the price for entry was some canned food. And we're also raising money for the Westside Food Bank in Los Angeles. And we ended up raising a total of 600 meals for impoverished in L.A. And I think that really kick-started internally, not just me learning from my father about giving of our time and our money, but also in the company. So our team here has gotten really excited about doing walks or builds for Habitat for Humanity. And anytime there's an opportunity for us to jump in, you know, we evaluate if that fits within our values, but we try to jump on as many of those opportunities as we can. And I think that's really helped that employee retention and passion for working together when we share the common common values of helping one another.
Well, that's
and
wonderful.
Contributing to our community.
That's wonderful. I really appreciate it. Now, tell me, you know, there are other CEOs out there, or presidents of companies, or business leaders who are moving into positions of responsibility where their father or their uncle has led the company before. If you had a minute and you could talk to them, what are two or three things that you would suggest that they do to ease that transition?
Well, I think, you know, for me, I feel like I've had a very unique situation that my father has been tremendous. You know, obviously, there's a lot of generational companies and families that have similar situations as I do. And in meeting with other people in the same situation as I have, I've come to appreciate my dad and his personality and the way he is. So, yeah, I can't give advice on that. But for me, it's been a lot about communication of expectations. You know, we've had some challenges, but talking them out has been, you know, the key to success there. So I think preservation of the family relationship is important, and to create boundaries for when, you know, work talk is off limits or on limits. I think that's really helped us a lot. And I also think to, like I said earlier, to seek the counsel of others. I think if I was resting solely on my dad's perspective, you know, we may have tunnel vision there, but he's encouraged me to look outside of the family for ideas, and that's benefited me a ton. So I think just having an open mind to what other people are doing out there has helped me a ton.
That's wonderful. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, Adam, and I'm impressed with somebody of your stature taking on responsibility and doing so well, and being so precise about what you're looking for and getting the kind of results that you're getting. Congratulations to you, and thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. Well, I really appreciate it.
There you have it. One more series of Pilgrim Talks as we look around Orange County and find those people who are leading businesses, leading thriving businesses, and finding out what they're doing to increase sales, increase that revenue, reduce their costs, increase productivity for their employees, help develop those employees to be the best that they can possibly be, and how to retain clients. The more that we find out about what is going on successfully in businesses around Orange County, the better business will be in Orange County, and the better business, the higher quality of life we have for everybody. That's what this pilgrim is looking for. I invite you to join me on the pilgrimage on the 405, which so many people take every day, as we continue to look for those thriving businesses and success and share those experiences with others. So I look forward to seeing you and hearing from you all through the week, and look forward to being with you again next Wednesday.
You've been listening to the one and only Will Crist, the original, the only Pilgrim on the 405, only on OCTalkRadio.net. Stick around. We've got a special edition of Critical Mass coming up next, talking about how you, too, can become part of our OC Talk Radio community by hosting your own show right here on OCTalkRadio.net.